This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Well, this is another interview that I'm doing, guys, with... We're going to have a talk about this guy's name because I can't say it right. But Alan, we're up at the last day of the New York State Convention. It's been a pretty good show, and we're all heading home. This is Sunday morning, And I got him out here under Rainy Pavilion, and we're going to talk about what he does and a little bit about ADC and some of the equipment. And I don't have any idea where this is going, and neither does he. But how do you say your last name, Alan? Because I don't think you're right.
Okay, it's a simple four-letter word. It's Huot. H-U-O-T as in Thomas.
But how does that pronounce ot?
Well, when you say the word got, right, O-T, so hu, H-U, and O-T, ot. It's
yeah.
It's a French name.
Well, see, there's the problem. You really expect an Appalachian male to be able to speak French?
Hey, and
because you emailed me or something. You're like, dude, you're saying my name wrong.
Like, well, weren't you saying it like Hewitt or yeah Hoot or Hout or some damn thing?
Huot.
Right.
I'm gonna have to remember God.
Huot.
All righty. So, for people who don't know who you are, go and introduce yourself, company, where you're from, all that type of stuff.
Well, my name's Al Huot, and I'm one of the owners of Wildlife Control Supplies. I'm from Connecticut. I've lived in Connecticut my whole life. Please don't hold that against me. For some of you folks that know what's going on in that state.
You're going to start carrying guns any day.
I don't know. That'd be a tough one. They make it tough in Connecticut. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we did have something tragic happen in the southern part of the state. It's tough to overcome that. I can understand there was a lot of emotions around it. There was a bunch of legislation passed that probably shouldn't have, and there's all kinds of court cases going on. So hopefully that'll get overturned. But so anyway, that being said, again, my company is Wildlife Control Supplies. We sell and manufacture wildlife control and animal handling equipment and distribute it all over the world, not just the U.S., although the U.S. is, you know, the biggest part of our market. We do
have the overseas market a big market?
I guess I would say sizable and growing. And maybe in some ways growing even at a faster rate than the domestic U.S. market. The U.S. market is established. There's distribution both for wildlife and animal control equipment, bird control, etc. It's not nearly as regulated as it is in other parts of the world. So, you know, I was just talking about this with somebody here at the convention, that in other parts of the world, there really aren't these free trappers, if you will. All of it's done by government trappers. And, mm-hmm. You know, just take, for example, the Netherlands. They trap millions of muskrats a year to protect their dikes, and not one of them is saved. There is no fur industry over there.
What's the reasoning? I mean, that's it's digging oil and just keeping the water you get out of there.
Kind of. You know, I guess from our perspective here in the U.S., we really can't understand it. I don't understand it. You know, I'd love to buy their muskrats by the bale if we could. You name it, foxes, parts that don't have raccoons, but certainly fox and muskrat, they do have some mink. Parts of Europe have quite a large wolf population. All of that is not done for fur. It's all done by government-sanctioned trappers that are being paid to trap, but not harvest. So all of that has to be thrown away. And to the point where, you know, I've talked to trappers in the Netherlands about their muskrats, and it's almost like one of these fearful things where, oh no, I can't keep even one, because if I get caught keeping one, I'll lose my job. So all of them are discarded. You don't get the glands, you don't get the hide, they don't do anything with the meat. All they're doing is protecting dikes. So, you know, again, the U.S. is kind of a unique environment that we have this free trapper industry, guys looking to trap, whether it be for a hobby and make some money on the side or for their sole income. It doesn't really exist in other parts of the world.
See, my Appalachian moonshine background, I'm just thinking, well, if they kept all those muskrats and eventually they did get caught, they'd be better off.
Yeah.
It's especially with the glands and everything else.
Well, even, you know, it's the same in England, it's the same in Spain, Portugal, Italy. You know, naturally they have much more restrictive laws than we have here. There is a little bit of snaring, some. Almost no foothold use in all of those countries that I mentioned, although there is some foot snare and our Collarum device, that the live capture device for canines. But so they're very restricted as to equipment. And
what about like Asia? I mean, do those countries buy traps to use?
You know, we don't see a lot from Asia. We see some. But it could just be that there's so many manufacturers in China, Taiwan.
That they just knock it off and sell it to them. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, okay. It could be. I don't believe that we see much, except for very specialized things, maybe for bird control, but certainly not wildlife or animal control. They're making it themselves. It's being made in Korea. It's being made in Taiwan. There isn't a week that goes by that I don't get several emails in my inbox from manufacturers in Asia wanting to make stuff for us. Mm. Or maybe they're already making things for other manufacturers and they want to add us on. But lots and lots of that stuff is being made in Asia. And maybe I'm guessing that's the reason we don't see much traffic from there.
What about South America?
Some there is
the beaver and mountain lion problems and
they have some jaguar problems in Argentina, beaver problems, but again we're not seeing the kind of demand from the U.S. and Europe that you know there's not much going on in South America, a lot of bird control. A lot of bird control, but not a lot of wildlife control. We just haven't seen it.
Hmm. Okay. Well, how did you get into this? I mean, this is a...
I met you
at these conventions.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're kind of the oddball out most of the time.
Yeah, I'm sort of the oddball out, and most of the time we feel sort of like the black sheep because we don't fit into the conventional fur trapping supply house, if you will. Although I think at the moment... at least on the East Coast, we're probably the largest trapping supply house on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's certainly larger ones in the Midwest, but I think we've achieved a place, at least on the East Coast, for supply there.
Well, you're not buying my stuff for bird control.
No.
So, I mean,
no.
You're selling it somewhere.
And it's moving. How I got started, you know, I fur trapped... since I was 10. And
Connecticut.
I've already admitted that I'm from Connecticut and I've lived there my whole life. but Connecticut was a much more rural place than it is now, and it's certainly the area that I lived. A lot of people probably have the impression of Connecticut that it's complete suburbia, house after house after house, and there are areas like that. But most of that is up the Connecticut River. The state is only 3 million acres. And it's basically bisected by the Connecticut River. So into two halves. Most of the population lives up the river, on both sides of the river. The extreme east and west of Connecticut are pretty rural and not populated. Even to this day, although they're more expensive than most people would care to live. Because of its close proximity to New York, we have a lot of New York people.
How close are you to the city?
I would say we're two and a half hours. We can be in New York City, downtown.
So people would go up there just to get away from the city and go like a bedroom community type thing.
Yeah, especially the northwest corner of Connecticut and that southern part right against New York. Very expensive properties, big estates. Lots of movie stars. I could, you know, go down the list of
names. That's where you live, right?
Yeah, no. I live on the very edge of that, Clint. So, you know, it's really expensive. And I think New Yorkers look at it as their kind of recreation area. So they'll buy second and third houses. Now, what that means to nuisance people is, and you know, there's a number of them, not just myself. I happen to live on the edge of a pretty good area for nuisance control. They're people that have money to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, both of them work more likely than not. Husband and wife work. The house is empty all day. Lots of big houses. And they don't know and they don't want to do any type of wildlife control. So they want, in many ways, everything done for them. You know, whether it be squirrels, skunks, raccoons, you know, down chimneys, bats in an attic, snakes under a deck. They want all of that done for them. They're not going to do it themselves. So from a nuisance perspective, at least in my neck of the woods, and I think that's what most guys find, even in other parts of the country, you know, California, Texas, Florida, all big customers for us, that we've gotten to a point in time now where there's lots and lots of people that are out employed in other occupations and they want wildlife or animal handling done for them. And hence the industry has flourished.
So did you, I'm just making an assumption, you went from fur trapping as a kid.
Yeah.
To seeing the nuisance thing.
Right.
And then you probably were like, we need more weird traps, so we're going to start what you're doing now. Is that how that kind of progressed?
Yeah, that's kind of a pretty good description of it. I took a little side trip there for a while. I did trap pretty extensively through the 70s, the fur boom. I was lucky enough to hit that. But then early 80s, I was married with a couple of kids and had a house and got into corporate America. So I took a 20-year kind of side path, which I think set both myself and my wife up for... and let me just say this, and even though she's sitting right here with me, that...
Go ahead and say hi since you're here.
Hi, everybody.
I wouldn't have been able to do this without her. You know, I have a wonderful partner. I am kind of the product side of the business, finding the next new product. That's my forte. That's what I like to do, get things manufactured. I'm not the financial wizard or the paperwork processor. I just can't do that. So, you know, the two of us in combination really did well. Or I guess complement one another.
You do know that you're, every time I try to get around paperwork, he says, you're the reason that I've got to do all this.
Yes, I get blamed for all the business aspects of it, but that gives him the opportunity to kind of go out and find new products and develop new products. And
so he leaves you with the boring work and he go does the fun stuff.
Yeah, we take care of the day-to-day to make sure product goes out the door and that we have it in stock, so...
So, you know, getting back to, you know, how it all started. So, I'd been in corporate America for, I don't know, 16 or 17 years. I was getting towards the end of, you know, that being, I guess I'll call it fun, but it was a great experience. I had a lot of good times out of it, experiences that I wouldn't have been able to do on my own.
Do you think that structure... But and like there's another big company that is a sponsor, and one of the owners came from corporate America. You come from corporate America,
right?
And your businesses are ran different, but they also seem to be more efficient and they grow quicker.
Yeah.
Do you think that came from that background?
I think there's no question that it really positions you and gives you the mindset and some of the skills that you need to run a business and especially grow a business in today's environment. You know, lots of people that we talk with that want to get into the nuisance business, they trap. And that's great if you have those skills. But those aren't the only ones you're going to need. Mm-hmm. You need business skills. And the other thing that I hear occasionally is...
You just can't help it. Like 2 acres, and they got 16 pieces of machinery running around all the time.
Oh yeah, yeah. And he's, well, at least he toned it down over there. And now it's raining like crazy. I'm glad I'm in the pavilion.
Hey, it was your idea. We'll blame it on you.
I know. Yeah. So I think you know, having corporate American skills and that background, even to make presentations,
mm-hmm.
or do a spreadsheet, or write up a proposal, or deal with people. That's the other thing, and that's what I was going to say, is that occasionally we'll have people come up to the booth and say that, wow, I really like to trap, so I'm thinking about getting into nuisance work, but I don't like dealing with people. And I try to steer them kind of, or at least counsel them that, well, maybe you want to think about it, because mm-hmm. more than 50% of the business is either on the phone or face-to-face dealing with people. And dealing with their issues and their emotions and, you know, what they think about how the animals should be handled and all of that. And if you're really this, you know, reclusive, you know, backwoods, don't want to deal with people, the ADC or the nuisance business, at least in suburbia, mm-hmm. might not be for you.
That's the reason I don't do it.
There it is.
I mean, I know that that's not a good fit for me.
Right.
Dump
right.
me on a 50,000 acre, tell me to go kill stuff, I'm good to go.
Right, right, right. But put you in the middle of suburbia, where you've got to deal with, you know, Susie or whatever, and, you know, what are you going to do with that raccoon? And, you know, you baited the trap this way, and I saw on the internet that it should have been baited that way. I mean, you get that all the time now. Mm-hmm. Most customers open with, well, I saw on the internet, and then it goes from there. So you need to be able to deal with that. And if you don't like dealing with people, and you know, tough customers and rude customers and demanding customers that ask you to do things that maybe even aren't good for your health, like going up on a roof when there's ice up there, then maybe that's, you know, it's not for you. Since I really got into the nuisance business, the services end of the business in 96, and started providing services.
So you were one of the, like Erickson and all that. Y'all were like the...
I'm a charter member of NUCOA, which is the right. Nuisance Wildlife Control Operators Association. Tim Julian was the first president. I'm a charter member of that. I got in on, you know, when the industry was really in its infancy. And I think maybe it's a, you know, now maybe it's a young teenager. I don't know. But, you know, I got into it early. I kind of looked around and said, at the end of my corporate career, and said, what could I do with myself? You know, how can I make a living? I wasn't happy in an office anymore. The only skill that I had, Clint, to be really honest with you, was I could trap. And I really enjoyed that. That's been my whole life. And you know, I guess my wife would agree with this, I'm obsessive about traps. That's what I like to do, and that's, you know, my passion.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, that's not going to pay the bills. So I looked at, well, geez, there's this thing called nuisance wildlife, and I see some trucks on the road, and geez, they're holding meetings. Maybe let me get involved in that. And what I started to see was that there wasn't any singular place to get all your supplies. Certainly there is a...
So you just saw the niche.
Yeah. It was a timing thing. It was a kind of a recognition thing. I saw the niche. You know, there were other things being done, like bat control. Well, geez, where do I get all that stuff? Where do I get bat netting? Where do I get closed cell foam? You know, things that hadn't even been invented yet. You know, you just saw that. Everybody was going to 15, 18, 20 different places mm-hmm. to get supplies. Yeah, they could get foothold traps and body gripping traps from the trapping channel. All of your supply houses, but they couldn't get all of the other things. Glue boards. Where do you get glue boards? Nobody even knew back then. It sounds kind of like a simple thing now, but mm-hmm. back then it was like, I don't even know where to get this stuff. So in 98, we started Wildlife Control Supplies. I wanted the name of the company to be
it's awesome
very
name.
Recognizable. I never wanted it to be a name that then people would say, but what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of stuff do they have? You know what I mean? So Wildlife Control Supplies says it all. That's what we do. And that's been our entire focus.
Kind of like Predator Control Group.
Exactly.
Pretty simple.
Right.
I mean, Billy Bob's,
yeah,
whatever.
You're not doing rodent control. Or you're not doing bird control, I'm guessing. It's Predator Control Group. So, you know, that's what I wanted the name to do and to be.
Which is a good lesson for someone that's looking to get into this.
Yeah, yeah.
When I started, you know, like, and names are important. When I first started lures, because of my sense of humor, I called it Big Country's Luscious Lures.
Yeah, Luscious.
Which I just thought that was funny.
Right.
Guys couldn't spell it, and they couldn't say it, and it took me like 6 months to go, that was a stupid thing to do.
Right, right, right. And you know what? You're not the only one that's made that mistake, because I'll share with you the name of my services business, which I thought was the same thing, but... very quickly I learned people can't spell the word nuisance.
Mm-hmm.
So the name of my nuisance business before we started Wildlife Control Supplies was Nuisance Wildlife Services. Now it made perfect sense to me. Nuisance Wildlife Services. I don't think I've run into a person on the planet, at least customers, that can spell nuisance. And they try to write it on a check or whatever. They can't spell it.
I mean, I can't even say your last name. So.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had to simplify it. And that's the reason we chose the, you know, Wildlife Control Supplies. And it's the premise right from day one was we want to have and supply everything that these guys need on their truck. And to this very day, we're still in that vein, right down to the hand wipes that you want to carry on your truck to clean your hands from job to job. You know, ladder accessories, safety equipment, HEPA respirators.
Like for going Urbano? Is that what that's for?
Right, right. Going into confined spaces so you're not breathing. Especially if you're doing a clean out, what they call a clean out of an attic or a crawl space. So you're down there in a Tyvek suit. A lot of this work is more, I guess I would say, maintenance type work or construction type work than trapping. You know, that's the other thing that we talk to so many people, but...
I do have a new product I want you to carry.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's guano.
Guano?
I got some from Norm about 3 years ago. He took out of an attic and I put it in a new blackberry bed.
Yeah.
Those blackberries were 16 foot tall.
They grow 100 miles an hour.
So since your guys get guano, if I had a place to get it and you weren't crazy on the price, I'd buy a bunch from you.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, but in all honesty and all kidding aside, they actually mine guano in parts of Mexico. They used to mine it in Arizona, although I don't think that they're doing that any longer. But yeah, some of the caves in Mexico, they'll mine it and they bag it and they sell it for fertilizer. If you can, you don't see it here much, but out west you'll see more of it.
Because of marijuana, honestly.
Maybe probably grow fast. Yeah, yeah. You know, everything on the truck, lots of stuff that you'd never think. Of in kind of the fur trapping vein, but we even have a product that it's cool to look at. It's called a net blaster, and we manufacture it, and it fires a 40 by 60 net out at 100 miles an hour and drops down over a flock of birds. And places like
Zoo. Would it work on politicians?
It probably would if you get them in a group. You know, put a donation check out in the middle of the field and fire the net over them. But some agencies are using it for deer.
Mm-hmm.
They want to capture a bunch of deer at once. They want to capture a flock of turkeys. National Wild Turkey Federation uses a number of them. USDA uses quite a few of them.
We see a lot, and I've never seen them do it, and I've never even thought about it until you said that, but the helicopters in Texas they net the deers out of the helicopter.
Right.
So that's the kind of product that's for.
It's kind of, yeah. But it's being used all over the world. I mean, we've sent them to the Amazon. Sent one to Botswana for the Denver Zoo. What's that?
Dubai.
We've sent them to Dubai, I think, for some pigeon control or whatever. But so we deal in a lot of traps, and not just fur trapping traps, but other types of bird traps, lots of bird traps, snake traps, not so many bat traps anymore. That's kind of gone by the wayside. It's all done with exclusion. So, you know, we've kind of grown up with the industry. I think we're in our 16th year now, somewhere in that neighborhood. And the industry continues to grow, and I think it's gonna grow even more than it is today.
That's a cool deal. Well, a lot of guys a lot of questions I get is always on ADC, mm-hmm. and I always tell them, you know, I'm talking about predator control and beaver control, but I don't know anything about that. And you may not want to answer this, and that's okay. But when I hear some of the numbers that people brag about, just like fur trappers do.
Right.
I think there's a lot of BS in that business, but I do think there can be at least a really good revenue stream come out of that for somebody.
Yes.
But not, I mean, they go into it think they're going to be making $300,000 because everybody makes $300,000 in the wildlife.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I don't believe it.
Well, and there are some that do.
Just like your NFL players.
Well, the ones that do that not only can trap, provide those kinds of services, but other services as well, and kind of expand beyond the mindset of just catching things. If we go back to what I was talking about earlier on the maintenance and construction, we have wildlife control operators that not only will get the skunk from under your deck, but also give you a proposal to exclude around the base of the deck so that skunks, possums, raccoons can't get under any longer. And maybe they charge by the foot for that. Or maybe if the deck is, you know, aged or in disrepair, they'll build you a new deck. Or squirrels chewing through the soffit of a house and getting into an attic. There's a number of guys, and these are the most successful guys that have multiple trucks on the road. They'll not only catch the squirrel, but they'll repair the soffit. I myself, personally, I'm not a carpenter. I never told people I was a carpenter. The only thing I will do is remove the animal and temporarily patch a hole. But the guys that kind of take it to the nth degree and can provide this full range of services, those are the ones making, you know, a significant amount of money. There's money to be made out there. That people want those services. So the more you can do, if you have a plumbing background, or if you have a construction background, a roofing background, if you have some masonry background, like bricks, chimneys, things like that, all of that helps in wildlife control. Knowing the construction of chimneys, how they're built, really important and valuable in the wildlife control world.
So this is the way my brain works, if I'm following what you're saying. If someone was, say, a trapper.
Yes.
Who wants to be an ADC guy.
Right.
He needs to make the choice that he learns, because I'm not a handy guy. You know, so, you know, I make a joke to Cindy all the time. You know, I only have one tool. It's a checkbook when it comes to building stuff because I'm not good at it. So, if I was wanting to get into this, I would have to figure out a way to be somewhat passionate and knowledgeable about plumbing and carpentry and use that as a self-education so I had different revenue streams to have a more stable business.
That would certainly be helpful. It would be absolutely helpful. The individuals that go into it thinking, all I'm going to do is trap, at least in our experience, some of that has a limited life expectancy. You can only make so much. The money, if you're looking at it for a a livelihood. This is what you're going to make your living at. You absolutely need to do more than trapping. If you're going to, you know, outside of what you've been talking about, the predator control and, you know, 50,000 acre ranches and that, mm-hmm. if you want to do what I guess I would say the majority of wildlife control operators are doing in suburbia, you need to do more. You won't make it with all of the overhead that you've got with just trapping. You've got to provide some other services, exclusion services, cleaning services, repair service, anything like that. For instance, beaver control. The people that are and I'll mention a state just because they have such severe restrictions on their trap, Massachusetts. Yeah, there's a lot of guys trapping beaver. They trap them for, you know, various companies and the railroad and things like that. But the people really making a good living, a significant amount of money, are the ones that not only will trap, but they'll also do culvert protection. That's or nice. They'll do water flow control devices that will, you know, control the level of the water for people. People are willing to pay for that. So it's like, don't turn up your nose to it and say, oh, I'm never going to, you know, provide water flow control devices. Go out and learn how to do them. Because would you rather trap for, I mean, I'm just going to throw out a number, $300 to $500 for the beaver? Or would you rather get $1,500 for the water flow control device? Or would you rather trap the beavers up front and then say, as a preventative, I'll do a water flow control device and make $2,000?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
When I was doing real heavy in the beaver work, I had that opportunity a couple times, and it made me nervous because I wasn't in the and I used to build swimming pools, so I understand, yep. you know, backhoes and yep. pipe and stuff like that. And these duck hunting clubs, they didn't want you to really wipe the beaver out, but they wanted to be able to run their boats where they wanted to run their boats. And they're like, there has to be a way that, you know, you could keep a maintenance program, which
right.
I was getting paid for.
Right.
And then we can have something in to regulate this water. And then when that gets out of whack, you come in and do your thing. So I did all this studying online. And if I remember right, they paid me $4,500 to put in three of these systems. I used their backhoe and their guy. I had to buy the pipe. And two of the four worked out okay, and the beaver kicked the other two's butt.
Okay.
But
okay.
I mean, that was a huge difference on me just going in there and getting paid at that time probably $1,200 a week or whatever I was
right.
charging.
Right, right, right. The more you can do and other services you can provide, that's where you really can make a good living and a significant amount of money. You know, they're. One of the things I'll mention is I did a demo here this weekend at the convention, and one of the questions I got, offhanded questions, was about insurance. Mm-hmm. And it was like, geez, I'm doing a nuisance wildlife demo, and I was talking about bats, and I was talking about raccoons and moles and that, but one of the things they wanted to know about was insurance. And you're going to have those kinds of overhead, because you're on people's properties. You can't work for a government agency unless you have a $2 million policy minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just that I'm going to go out and maybe there's some vehicle costs. There's other costs involved that that are overhead that you need to build into your prices. So I know guys here, you know, oh, I'm, you know, getting this much for a raccoon job, or I'm getting that much for a bat job or whatever, but there's a lot of overhead to it, too, that needs to be accommodated. You know, you're working for yourself. If you're not only paying yourself, you're insuring yourself, you got your vehicle wear and tear, you got, you know, whatever it is, $3.50 to $4 a gallon for gas, and all of that comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I tell guys a lot, especially single operators, guys that, you know, they have one truck, it's themselves and a ladder. You only need to fall one time and you're out of business. So you need to be as safe as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You always need to think about safety in this business, because, you know, a lot of it is done at a height. You're up above the ground level. If you don't like ladders and you don't like to climb, you need to figure out other aspects of the business. Exactly.
I don't want to do it.
Well, you need to figure out other aspects of the business that you can make money at then. But, you know, there's those kinds of things. Health insurance that needs to be paid for. A company's not paying for it. You are.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times guys will hear the big numbers, but and there is good money to be made. I'm not trying to fool anybody here. There's a lot of overhead, too, that
you run
into.
It's just like these shows. Dealers that sell mostly what they buy from somebody else, for them to actually take home after expenses $4,000,
they're
going to have to move $25,000 worth of product.
Right.
But the person that doesn't deal with that every day, they just think, look, he made $25,000. No, he made $4,000.
Right.
Now he's going to go buy inventory back.
Right. And that's... That's what you've got to take into account when you're doing this type of work, is what's the overhead, and where do you set your pricing? And, you know, that's the other common question out there. It's, you know, well, how much do you charge for that? Or how much? The easiest thing is to call around the area. I can't tell you what to charge in your area. You're from Tennessee. I'm from Connecticut.
Two totally different worlds.
In your world, people for certain aspects of wildlife control may be even willing to pay more than what they're going to pay in my area. I can't tell somebody from Buffalo, New York, what to charge. I can give them a range, but the easiest thing to do is just call around the area. Maybe look, Yellow Pages, I'm kind of dating myself. Nobody uses Yellow Pages anymore. Go on the internet and type in wildlife control for your area, and then call around and say, "Hey, I've got a raccoon in my chimney." It's not unethical. It's just you're trying to determine what your charges are. Mm-hmm. I've got a raccoon in a chimney. How much would you charge? And then operate accordingly.
And I think just from what I've learned in predator control, you have to be willing to walk away from probably a lot of jobs if you're not going to make any money, because I know a lot of guys that do beaver control that they would actually make more money sitting on their front porch drinking tea.
Yeah.
But they're working to lose money, and it doesn't make any sense.
Well, some of it's ego, especially people just starting out in business. They want to get every job. And I told somebody here at the convention this weekend, one of the things in this industry, everybody's afraid of rejection. I don't want to be rejected. So if I give them a price and they say no, that's a bad thing. Well, you know, I've gone to seminars and listened to Harvard Business School professors, and if you're not getting 15-20% rejection, your price is too low. If every time you give out a price and the person says yes, your price is too low. Bump it up by $5. Bump it up by $10. When you start getting 15-20% rejections, your price is about right. If you go into this with the attitude, and we've seen, I guess at this point, hundreds of guys that'll go into it and say, you know what? I'm going to charge $25 for every raccoon, and I'm going to get all the business in my area. That, you know, they're running around nights, weekends, day and night doing jobs, not making any money. And within a year, maybe two, almost all of them are out of business.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be the low-cost provider and provide excellent service. It just doesn't work. So at some point in time, either their truck's going to break down, they can't repair it, they don't have insurance, whatever it is. But you can't go into this with the mindset of, I'm going to charge the lowest possible price, get all of the work from all of the other people around me, all of my supposed competitors, and that's how I'm going to build my business. If you go in with that attitude, you are going to fail. I'm absolutely confident of that.
Because everything costs so much now.
Right.
And one thing on price that I've seen, there's been a lot of guys come in and fall out of what I do, like in Texas, and we're definitely probably one of the most expensive out there. And it doesn't bother me at all. See, my rate's probably closer to 50%, and I'm happy with that.
Right.
Because
okay.
There's only 52 weeks in a year.
Right.
You know, you don't only do so much work. But I see a lot of guys that'll come in and they price it just kind of like, well, I want to get my fuel paid for and maybe some groceries, and then I'm going to catch the fur. And especially when you're dealing with high-end customers like I deal in, they don't trust them.
Right.
You know, they'd lose money because no one will hire them because they're too cheap.
Right. Well, they actually look at them like something's got to be wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you charging so little? So I guess I would say to everybody, you know what, do your homework. Check around your local area. Set your prices at a competitive level. You don't have to be the least costly, or you don't have to be the most expensive. You know, be competitive. And you'll be successful. That's really the thing that will turn the tide for you. But the trying to be the least cost provider, you're going to run yourself into the ground. Your the quality of life is not going to be great, and you probably are going to fail.
Well, the way I look, now tell me if I'm wrong, because I've said some stuff like this before. I'm a niche guy. I like niche things that I can get in and create a big presence for and build a name for. And I know guys in the industry that I've watched on your industry, they do all that other stuff, but they're known as the, like, mole guy.
Right.
Like, we both know a trapper that lives in Ohio. He traps out of a Mercedes, and he's got a system for moles.
Yep.
And he's got a business model for moles that's reoccurring income all the time. He does all that other stuff too, but he's the mole guy.
Right, right.
You know, and I'm sure from my point of view, because if I was going to get in that industry, and it's, say there's in Dunlap, which there's no people there, but if there was, I look in there and there's six wildlife control businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's going to separate me from those other six?
Right.
So I'm going to pick what I think I can do the best at, make the most money at, the least amount of energy, and I'm going to market for that, and then pick up the other parts that just kind of fall in my lap. But I want to be the whatever guy.
Right. Right. No, that's a smart way of doing it. There's no question. You know, that you made that observation that there's the mole guy. There was another person here at the convention this weekend that's kind of the bat guy. You know, there's several bat guys around, but you know, the one that was here.
But they market themselves that way.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's that's kind of their primary focus is bats, and they're a specialist at that. Now they'll do other things, kind of to smooth out those peaks and valleys of bat work, because bat work is somewhat seasonal, especially in the Northeast, northern tier estates, up in the Great Lakes. Naturally, they're about the same climate we are, so in the winter it shuts down. But you know, they will do those other, the raccoons, the skunks, the squirrels, but their main focus is perhaps bats. Other people focus on moles. There's other people that do a ton of bird work, and then within bird work there's
that
people
seems that, like a specialty to me
it is a,
because I don't know anything about
well,
it.
Well, it is a specialty, and you know, it's a huge there's a huge demand for it. Again, you gotta like heights. Lots of times rent lifts to get up to places, or rappel, which, you know, that's out of my league.
See, I don't mind rappelling, but you put me on a roof and I have to get in. If I was 6'5", I don't think I could stand up.
You know, netting and all of that is typically at a height.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, bird control is a specialty. But even within bird control, there's people that do just geese. You know, that's their whole thing. They're gonna addle eggs. They're gonna haze the geese with different either pyrotechnics or coyote decoys or whatever. Maybe some of them will chase them with dogs, or put up barriers against the water so they can't go from the lawn to the water. Others do roundups. They round them up in these big trailers, take them away. Sometimes they relocate them, sometimes they euthanize them. But I mean, there are definite specialties within wildlife control, And you just have to find out the one that you're kind of passionate about, mm-hmm. or what you have a skill for.
Because to me, just from someone getting in, from someone that looks at marketing, it would scare me to death. And I've done a lot of business consultation with trappers.
Right.
And the first question I always ask them is, who is your customer? And I've yet to have anybody that's not, that's like their ADC, anybody with a house, you know, or anybody that'll pay me, or, you know, and we try to carve that down to what it is. So you've got a chance to market to those people instead, because no one's got the budget to go market
to everybody.
Like Orkin.
No, no.
You know, you're not going to be able to do that.
No.
So to me, I think niche is one of the biggest.
You know, and you know what helps with that though, Clint, and you know, we're all lucky enough to have it now. It didn't exist back in the mid 90s, but you know, towards the latter part of the 90s, that Nuisance Wildlife Control Operators Association was formed. They have classes, they have expos. The next expo is going to be in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They were holding them in Las Vegas. They've been tending to move them around now, but. You know, it's kind of the thing where if you want to get involved in wildlife control, there's some excellent resources out there now that didn't exist 15 years ago to learn about all of these different avenues, to go and, you know, listen to a guy on insurance, you know, listen to a guy about animal diseases and maybe some vaccinations you want to think about. Or, you know, listen to about bat control or mole control. One of the up-and-coming ones right now is deer control. I mean, so there are guys out there that, you know, they really like, again, they have a fondness for, say, firearms maybe. They're good at shooting. Maybe you came out of the military and, you know, I'm just throwing this stuff out there. Maybe you were a sniper in the military and you're sitting, you know, you just got out and you're like, geez, what can I do? Well, maybe I could get into deer control, or I could get into hog control. There is a gentleman down in Georgia that his whole company is...
Jagger Pro.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He was in the military. Most of the guys that he employs, I believe, were in the military. You know, they have all high-end weapons, night vision, thermal imaging cameras, and they go out and they were snipers. And they offer hog control as a service. That's all they do. So, you know, if you have a skill that you can build on, that's great. If you and maybe the skill is purely just trapping, like what I had. But there's certainly educational resources out there now that can help you kind of decide, okay, what vein do I want to go in? The other nice thing, and I know it's changed dramatically in my lifetime, even in the fur trapping arena. When I was, you know, when I was smaller, maybe when you were smaller, Clint, you know, nobody would tell you anything. I mean, a dirt hole was a secret when I was a little kid. Just trying to find out how to trap a fox was this mysterious, you know, cloaked in secret, and you wouldn't think of just asking somebody, you know, how to do it, or a mink. You know, no one would tell you. But the nuisance industry isn't like that. We may be competitors in the area, or, you know, hopefully friendly competitors, but at least my experience has been that it's much more open.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, look at you as a competitor, or you're stealing my secret or whatever. If I can share something with you and it helps you build your business down in Tennessee, I'm more than happy to do it. And I would go out on a limb and say that that's the way most guys are, especially if you attend some of these wildlife control seminars or conventions. Everybody's there for the same reason, bettering their business. So it's a much more, at least to me, much more energized, positive, sharing environment. You know, what do I use for bookkeeping? I mean, that, you know, what do I do there? You know, how do I register my business? All of that information is there. Guys are willing to help you with it. And that's how a lot of guys get started, just mingling with some of the guys in the business.
Now, at the conventions you're talking about, do they actually have training for guys if they wanted to learn how to do these specific, or how would someone go about the training of that if they didn't know?
Well, a couple different ways. of late, within the past couple of years, at these conventions, they actually try to tack on a day or two for hands-on training. So some of it is like basic operator training, some of the basic skills and maybe some of the tools, the basic tools that you use and how to use them. But excuse me, now they're getting into even more advanced things like this one in Myrtle Beach. I believe they're actually scheduling a class to go out to a building and do some bird work. Mount nets, exclude the birds. I think it's pigeons that they're going to work on this time. But it's a day and a half class just on bird control. So,
is there no one doing like what I do at our Texas trapping schools that do that?
But the happening of it is sporadic. It's not at least yet a yearly basis. There is some bat courses available. There is a gentleman in Ohio offering, you know, bat removal classes. That would be something you could go to. Some of the guys that have been in the business for a long time do, subcontract or contract out, bring guys in two or three at a time, let them ride around with them for a few days and kind of teach them the ropes. There aren't a lot of... what you're doing.
So that part of your industry is still in the infancy.
It absolutely is.
That could be a revenue stream for people.
Yeah, there was a training effort, it's probably 5 years now, where they were doing it for several years, where it was a week-long course in Indiana, and it was kind of soup to nuts, almost like the Predator Control Group would do, or maybe the Fur Takers College, mm-hmm. something like that. That's kind of, you know, a couple of guys have passed on. It's kind of fallen apart. I would say the educational part of our industry still isn't quite formed. It is available, but it's not organized.
Okay. Well, you know, I get tickled when I used to, I would just go to different sponsors' websites and I would, you know, just go to a page and say you can get this and this. I couldn't do that to yours because I'd go to a page and I'd be like, you can get, and I'd be in my mind, I'm going, what the heck is that?
Yeah, well, you know, again, that's back to there are lots of unusual things that, you know, guys are, you know, Tyvek suits. Nobody in the fur industry has a use for one. Well, maybe skinning. When I was I went down to the Leggetts a couple times, and they would use Tyvek suits to skin with, mm-hmm. and then they'd peel them off every night, you know, keep the fleas off them and all of that. But, you know, for the most part, there's not a use for them in this industry. But yet, in the wildlife control industry, lots of uses for different types of gloves, maybe animal handling gloves that are Kevlar lined, so it prevents the animal from biting through to your hand. Mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of things, nets and poles and scopes to look into things, or maybe thermal imaging cameras to look in a wall and find a rodent, you know, things like that. There's just a whole range of tools that guys are using to provide service, you know, beyond the, you know, foothold or body grip, mm-hmm. or, you know, wire and stake type of thing.
Well, this has been very interesting. I find what y'all do very interesting. I just don't want a part of it. But the business part of what y'all do, I find very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, as far as the control side.
Well, it's still growing. That's what excites us. You know, like I said, I think we're in our 16th year or thereabouts. It's been very good for us. Hopefully, we've you know, given back to it. You know, I travel all over the country, you know, talking about wildlife control and the industry, and you know how, I guess, fortunate I was that I picked the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was somewhat of a timing thing, but I also have a great partner that helped me out. So, you know, we're excited to be here. The industry's still growing. You know, lots of, you know, fur trappers every year kind of consider it, and for those that, you know, decide to get into it, we'd be more than happy to talk with them or help them out. We've been kind of, you know, at one end of the spectrum, and you know, I'm sure we could help them get started. So,
Well, if there's 80 ADC guys listening to this, and because the tools are so special or specialized,
right,
and I'm sure situations are so different with different things, and they were, I mean, you manufacture a lot of products.
Right.
Would, I mean, are you someone that they could bring an idea to?
Oh, absolutely. We get that a lot. We get that many times, especially at these shows where, you know, somebody will come by the booth and, you know, say, hey, I've been thinking about this, or I've been using this way. You know, could you make that? And we've done that many, many times. And we've, you know, we have a very good, you know, I guess I'll toot my horn a little bit. You know, we've got a great reputation for that. It's, if you come to us with an idea, it's never our idea. We'll help, you know, bring it to market, whether you want us to manufacture it or you're manufacturing it, but you want us to distribute it. You know, we've worked with many, many people. We have a number of products on the market right now that, you know, maybe you decide you want us to manufacture it and we're just, you know, paying you a commission or whatever it is.
I think there should be something said about that, though. If you're going to manufacture something to get it to somebody like you, mm-hmm. you've actually got to be able to do it.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
Right.
In any amount of volume.
Right, right. The problem becomes where, and I've seen this lots of times, where, you know, somebody will come to us, and I think you and I have talked about this before, with a product and say, hey, I've got this cool thing here, whatever it might be, and I'll make it if you'd sell it for me. And or in the early years, you know, we would latch on to every product like that. But what I found, even very recently, is people like making the first one, or they like making the first 10. But once we start to sell it and develop a market for it, because that's what we do, that's our specialty, we develop the market. You may have thought about it, but we can actually get it out to the masses. And once we start that, we can't stop it. And our reputation depends on it. So if you start making something and then stop, it makes Wildlife Control Supplies look bad. And we try to insulate ourselves from that now. So I'm really upfront with people. It's like, are you really sure you want to manufacture this? Do you understand that the first one was a lot of fun? And I know it's an ego thing. You want to walk all over this convention and show it to people. But at the end of the day, when I want 50 a week, or I want 100 a month, I'm not the bad guy. I developed the market for it. I've got customers out there that I have to supply. So I make people at least think about it now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, I really want you to think long and hard about it. Do you really want to be out in your garage every night hammering this thing out? Because once I turn the faucet on, it's very difficult to turn it off, and I'm the one that they see, not you.
Mm-hmm.
See, a lot of guys don't understand that.
Well, when I first started making those grizzle getters, I would make, I made one for myself and a few for buddies.
Right.
And then people would see them and they'd want me to make them some, and it was cool. You know, I wouldn't spend a lot of time, and then I started getting where I was doing 100 a year, and that wasn't too bad. And then they got into certain catalogs, and I was doing about 800 a year, and it sucked.
Right.
Because right. I'm not a knife maker. It was just right. a cool idea that worked right. very well.
Right.
And, you know, eventually I found somebody that wanted to get in the business, and I'm like, well, let me show you what I can get you into.
Right, right,
you know, and,
right.
And I used to be, well, we can make this, we can make that. Now my answer, nope. I
right.
don't.
Right.
And if you're going to be a trapper, you can't be a manufacturer.
And you're not unlike lots of guys. I mean, it is fun. You know, trappers by their very nature are inventive and are creative. And you have to be. But they're not manufacturers. And unless, I suppose, you've worked in a factory and been told to make 1,000 a day on something, you don't even understand what it is that, you know, it's going to take to do this every day, day in and day out. And so, you know, we're sensitive about that now. We try to steer guys away from it, to be honest with you. That, you know, our preference is we would take it, we'll get it manufactured, we'll come to some amicable agreement on, you know, pay structure or whatever. But that kind of insulates us from the guy that, you know, 3 months into it says, well, I want to go trapping. I'm not going to make any more for another 4 months. You know, that won't fly. It doesn't work.
Well, as we close, most people know how to get in touch with you. Tell us how to do that, and what is your last words of wisdom to someone looking at ADC?
My last words of wisdom are, don't try to be the low-cost competitor.
Don't do interviews in a fairgrounds.
Don't do interviews at a fairgrounds. That's right. Exactly. But to get a hold of us is very simple. It's Wildlife Control Supplies is the name of the company. The short website is shopwcs.com. So shopwcs.com. Or our office number is 860-844-0101. Again, my name's Alan Hewitt. I'm one of the owners of Wildlife Control Supplies. I've got a great team behind me. Been in it a long time. If you're looking to start in the business or even have been in the business a while and you're having any problems or need some help, feel free to give us a call. We're there, you know, Monday through Friday. Be glad to help.
Well, thanks a lot, man. This is enjoyable.
Thank you, Clint.